From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, the Michigan ACLU says documents show racial profiling when a Grand Rapids police captain tipped off immigration about the arrest of a Marine combat vet.
All he saw was a photo of Hilmar Ramos Gomez and heard his name, which he said is a Hispanic-sounding name, and that is the entire basis he used to contact ICE.
Environmental groups raise concerns as Marathon asked the city of Detroit for a variance in a city law.
To be exempt from the requirement that they fully enclose all of their petroleum coke storage and handling operations.
Business friendly, what does that mean to women and minority business owners?
We need to face up to the data about women and minority-led firms and realize that we still really don't have a level playing field out there.
Those stories and more today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. MSU's men's basketball team beat the Michigan Wolverines in a hard-fought game at Chrysler Arena Sunday. We're going to talk to John Eubakin about what this means in the race for the Big Ten title and on to March Madness. But first, the ACLU of Michigan is accusing Grand Rapids police of engaging in racial profiling when one of its officers contacted immigration authorities after the arrest of a Marine combat veteran last December. ICE held Hilmar Ramos Gomez for 3 days at a detainment center. He was released when a lawyer provided ICE with proof of citizenship. Michigan Radio's Dustin Dwyer is here with us from West Michigan. Dustin, refresh our memories about just why this American-born Marine combat vet was arrested and then detained.
Well, he was initially arrested by Grand Rapids police for trespassing on the helipad area at Spectrum Butterworth Hospital in Grand Rapids. Police say he also set a fire. So Grand Rapids police says that that incident, because the helipad area is sort of a sensitive area, that incident caused them to contact federal authorities over potential terrorism claims. And as part of that, one of the officers, Captain Kurt Vanderkoy, reached out to Immigration and Customs Enforcement and wrote an email asking them to check Hilmar Ramos Gomez's status.
And 3 days of being detained, did he not have his passport with him?
He had his passport with him. In fact, it's noted in the Grand Rapids Police Department, the Police Department police report, which the ACLU of Michigan obtained and shared with us today. It notes that his passport was on him. An attorney for the ACLU of Michigan also says he had a state license on him, which was real ID compliant, showing that he was a U.S. citizen. That was with him the entire time. The ACLU of Michigan is saying it was clear that this was a U.S. citizen and a veteran and that he should never have been taken into custody by ICE, never should have been in that detention center in the first place.
And what else did we learn from the ACLU as far as communications between Captain Vanderkoy and ICE?
Well, the ACLU has released a bunch of communications from lots of officers at Grand Rapids Police who were involved in the investigation. And what they show is some conflicting information. For example, on Friday, Grand Rapids Interim Police Chief David Kittle said that the contact with ICE was entirely appropriate because Officer Vanderkoy thought that there might be a terrorism-related incident here. But one of the documents obtained by the ACLU of Michigan is a text from another officer who was actually on the scene at the time and was investigating the incident. He texted an FBI contact and said this was a vet PTSD, but not a FBI issue. That text happened hours before Vanderkoy contacted ICE with the question about Hilmar Ramos Gomez's status. In fact, the ACLU of Michigan claims that Vanderkoy was off duty at the time he contacted ICE. So there are really some new questions about this whole claim that ICE was contacted because of these terrorism concerns.
Particularly, what did the ACLU point to that raises concerns of racial profiling?
That Vanderkoy, in his initial email, only asked about status, and Miriam Aukerman of the ACLU of Michigan says that, in fact, with her conversations with Grand Rapids Police, she says that Vanderkoy was actually off duty and watching the news, and all he saw was a photo of Hilmar Ramos Gomez and heard his name, which she said is a Hispanic-sounding name, and that is the entire basis he used to contact ICE. Now, we haven't confirmed that. I don't know where Captain Vanderkoy was when he got this news, but that's their claim, and that's why she says it's a very clear case of racial profiling.
Now, have you been able, Dustin, to talk with the Grand Rapids Police? I'm wondering what their response is to this.
They put out a statement on Facebook on Friday. I did reach communications person at the department over the weekend to ask if they had anything further. She said the statement issued on Friday will be their only statement. That statement came from the interim police chief, and he said they've conducted their investigation and found that Vanderkooy did nothing wrong. He did say that Vanderkooy used unprofessional language in his communications with Immigration and Customs Enforcement. I think that refers to an email that had the subject line, which included the word loco, the Spanish word for crazy, and described in that email who knows what his mad intent was going up on the helipad. The ACLU of Michigan says this is taunting Hilmar Ramos Gomez for his PTSD and clear mental issues that he has as a result of his service in the war in Afghanistan. So that was the statement from Grand Rapids Police. We haven't had any further statement from them on this.
And what is the ACLU looking for? What do they want?
Well, when I talked to Miriam Aukerman this morning, she said one thing that they're looking for is more accountability from the Grand Rapids Police and, frankly, from all of the other agencies that were involved here. This wasn't just a Grand Rapids Police issue. Hilmar Ramos Gomez was lodged in the Kent County Jail. When ICE took him into custody, he was transferred to the Calhoun County Jail because Calhoun County is the county that houses immigration detainees. So she's looking for government officials at all of those places to take more responsibility. And she specifically said that she believes Grand Rapids Police needs more civilian oversight because the results of this investigation show that they clearly can't police themselves.
Michigan Radio's Dustin Dwyer checking in from West Michigan. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
In 2013, huge piles of black powder and ash were stacked up along the Detroit River. Petroleum coke, pet coke. Big clouds of black dust swirled over the neighborhoods of southwest Detroit. Environmental concerns led the city to pass an ordinance requiring cancer-causing substances like pet coke to be properly stored in a covered area. Now Marathon wants the city to allow it to store its pet coke uncovered. Nick Leonard is executive director of the Great Lakes Environmental Law Center. Nick, remind us again, just what is pet coke?
Pet coke is essentially a byproduct of oil refining. And so Marathon has a good deal of it at its petroleum refining facility in southwest Detroit. You talked about some of the health effects, and they're really serious ones. It can be a carcinogen. It can contain some toxic substances. It's also an exceptionally dusty material, which we saw with the dust cloud blowing across the Detroit River and obscuring the view of the Ambassador Bridge. Studies from the city of Chicago have in fact found petroleum coke storage facilities can contribute to highly localized hotspots of particulate matter pollution, with particulate matter levels as high as 42 times the national ambient air quality standards. It's a serious pollutant.
And here we have pet coke being stored very closely to densely populated neighborhoods, which led to the city of Detroit passing its own ordinance to govern storage of pet coke. But now Marathon wants to be exempted from that ordinance. What do they want?
Right. Well, the big thing that they want is to be exempt from the requirement that they fully enclose all of their petroleum coke storage and handling operations. What Detroit did was really groundbreaking. If you wanted to store petroleum coke, handle it in the city of Detroit, you only could do it in a completely enclosed structure. And the reason for that is because of the health effects we just discussed. And now what Marathon is asking for is basically to continue to operate as they have in the past, which is to have their petroleum coke storage and handling operations uncovered. And they're also asking for exemptions from a few other requirements as well, including testing requirements and requirements aimed at making sure that their trucks that are leaving the facility don't track dust out into Detroit's roadways.
And the city department that administers this ordinance is the Buildings, Safety, Engineering, and Environmental Department, which everybody calls BSEED. And you're concerned BSEED isn't following the city's own rule?
Yeah, very concerned. We were working on this ordinance when it was in draft form. And one of the things that we paid really close attention to was what are the points where the public can have input into the process. Specifically for variance requests like this that Marathon is requesting, we made sure that the ordinance had language that allowed the public to receive notice of any variance application, to be heard at a public hearing, and to submit comments. Specifically, what the ordinance requires is for the city to give 14 days notice prior to any public hearing, and that notice has to be published on their website. Here, the city held a public hearing at the end of January, but hadn't properly noticed that meeting. So they basically didn't publish any notice online. And so residents just didn't know about it. And now we've asked the city to hold another public hearing. We think that it's important that they strictly follow the procedures that are described in the ordinance so that all members of Detroit have the opportunity to provide meaningful input on this really important issue.
Can the public comment on this?
The city is accepting public comments now until March 18th, and you can submit them online. But once again, how the public usually gets engaged in issues like this is at a public hearing. Unfortunately, the public didn't know about the public hearing because it wasn't properly noticed. The city didn't publish the notice of it on their website.
And why do you think this is? Why isn't the department playing by the city's own rules?
You know, it's a good question. This is a new issue. You know, this is the first variance request that the city has received regarding this ordinance. It's possible that they were just unaware, and I'm definitely willing to give them the benefit of the doubt. But now that they know that they haven't followed the ordinance, since this is the first variance application, and since this will set the precedent, so to speak, I think it's really, really important that the city strictly follow the requirements of the ordinance so that we get this right.
We've seen dueling opinion pieces, for example, in the Detroit Free Press with Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib accusing Marathon of disregarding public health to save money by not having to build a roof over its petcoke storage. And the refinery general manager at Marathon in Detroit said, hey, we handle our petcoke responsibly. He said, we have 30-foot high walls. We keep it watered down with a sprinkler system. He said, we even wash the wheels of the trucks that carry the petcoke. He says it's other companies who aren't handling the bulk materials responsibly. What do you say about each argument?
We know petroleum coke is an issue. We've seen it firsthand in the city of Detroit with the dust clouds. And we also have scientific studies backing that up, saying that, yes, these facilities can cause serious, highly localized hotspots of particulate matter pollution that can impact people's health, and that those issues aren't adequately regulated at the state level. What I want to see from Marathon is a solid argument that this variance will not create a public nuisance and that it will not have an adverse impact on the public health of people in the surrounding area. I don't think they've done that with their current application, and I think they could submit more information and have that application be better.
Nick Leonard, Executive Director of the Great Lakes Environmental Law Center. Thanks so much, Nick.
Thank you.
And we've received a statement from David Bell, who directs Detroit's Buildings Safety Engineering and Environmental Department, BSEED. In summary, it says the department issued notices to every dwelling or business within 300 feet of the location in question and posted notice of the meeting in the Detroit Legal News. Notice was not published on BSEED's website due to, in his words, human error, and says the city regrets the oversight. However, the law department has reviewed the matter and maintains that another meeting to accept public comment is not required. Lots more to come here on Stateside. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. For years now, the Michigan Humanities Council has worked to expose as many people in Michigan as possible to the humanities. Now they're announcing their first ever statewide Michigan Humanities Awards. Shelley Hendrick Kasprzycki is the president and CEO of the Michigan Humanities Council. Shelley, welcome back to Stateside.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Remind us again how long the Michigan Humanities Council has been sharing its passion for the humanities in Michigan.
Since 1974, we're one of 56 councils around the country, and it's such exciting work to be a part of.
For 45 years.
45 years.
And this year you are doing a first. You're creating the Michigan Humanities Awards. Tell us about those.
Yes, the Michigan Humanities Awards, we feel, are an excellent opportunity to recognize the wonderful partners that we have all around the state of Michigan. And in my travels from tiny town to big city in Michigan, it's amazing to see the work of really sharing human stories through museums and literature and culture. And so we're having three awards this year. First ever, we'll have the Corporate Humanities Champion Award, which will really recognize our corporate partners and those that give so much to bring humanities to life within their communities or around the state. We also have the Humanities Champion of the Year, because there's many individuals that work so incredibly hard to make humanities happen in their communities. And then lastly, we'll have Community Partner of the Year. And the reason for that award is to recognize the libraries and the cultural centers and the museums and all of the wonderful organizations that take part in making human stories really come to life.
And I know you have someone kind of exciting coming in for the awards ceremony on May 16th.
We do. We are thrilled to have Carrie Kennedy coming in. Carrie Kennedy is a wonderful author and also chairperson of Amnesty International's Leadership Council. Carrie has been a longtime human activist and human rights activist, rather. And also, she is the seventh child of Robert F. Kennedy and Ethel Kennedy. And we're really excited to have her because she brings a voice, I think, to Michigan that really recognizes the work that we do here in humanities and will bring, you know, a really special element to our award ceremony.
And what kinds of activities are you thinking of when you think in terms of special actions that deserve honoring, such as?
Well, when you think of partners like Meyer Corporation, who has sponsored Great Michigan Read and really made it possible for 12,000 books to be distributed in the tiniest towns in Michigan, or you think of the Jury Foundation in Midland that provides support to tiny organizations within their own community to have that historical event come to life. You think of community partners like, let's say, the Ojibwa Cultural Museum in St. Ignace, where the stories of tribal schools, the mission schools, come to light and racial healing takes place. Those types of events are the ones that we really want the chance to honor.
And how can people, who is allowed to nominate and how can the nominations be submitted?
Well, we'd like people to visit our website, which is brand new today. You're the first to hear of our rebranding that has taken place. We're actually going to be dropping council from our name. We'll be known as Michigan Humanities, emphasis on human. And so if people visit michiganhumanities.org, you can see our wonderful new website. And the nominations process is right on the front. It's simple. It's online.
Finally, just overview. Why is this work important? Why are the humanities so important to Michigan?
It really is how people connect to one another. People have a hard time understanding what humanities means, but it's really the way that we're able to connect to one another. So when you think of, let's say, in the workplace, the example of people being able to understand those who might be from another culture, when you think of reading and discussing a book and getting some real conceptual learning from it, when you think of understanding the history of how something came to be and why that made a difference in your town, that's really what humanities are all about.
Seems like the threads that bind us together.
Indeed.
Once again, the website for nominations is michiganhumanities.org, which marks the transition from the Michigan Humanities Council to Michigan Humanities. And we've been talking with its president and CEO, Shelley Hendrick Kisprisky. Thanks for being with us on Stateside, Shelley.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Wayne State University Press is out with a new compilation of essays by award-winning Michigan authors. The book's title, Elemental, a collection of Michigan creative nonfiction. As writer Kelly Forden tells us in her review, we are lucky to have this many extraordinary writers living in our state.
As the anthology editor Anne-Marie Oman notes in the introduction, Michigan is a complex place, and if any book could come close to harnessing that complexity, this one does. The range of subject matter is staggering, and according to Oman, organizing the material was no easy task. In the end, she decided to present these essays in four sections through the lens of the elements we are shaped by: earth, wind, fire, and water, in order to better reflect some of the intrinsic themes in Michigan literature: survival, transformation, tenacity, grit, and a sometimes grueling independence. In one chapter, the reader will learn about bending nails at a construction site in Glen Arbor. In the next, moving up north as an Arab American woman. 1 minute, the reader will be transported to the Shaman Drum bookstore with the poet Keith Taylor as he happens upon a long-lost ancestor in an obscure bargain book. And in yet another essay by Marty Jo Link, the reader will follow a crime writer whose own family member is being victimized by a teenage derelict. The opening essay, Earth, by Teresa Skolin, brought me to tears with its vivid descriptions about growing up in the thumb and her beautiful ruminations about grief and aging, including this one. You remember the silence of your grandfather, whose silence was a field, a space around him. Nothing you see now is new. Everything reminds you of something else, someone you knew who is now gone. Wendell Berry says that you become like a tree standing over a grave. Some days you wish for someone to hear and see and witness all the memories you carry. Some days you understand that speaking of it only goes so far, only blunts the sharp edges. In Rhoda Jansen's essay, Unforgettable Baby, she writes about becoming a middle-aged, first-time step-parent with hilarious precision. Jansen explains that she had watched her graduate school cohort become parents for the first time, reading Saussure and conversing about sparkly ponies at the same time, while Jansen herself continued to experience parenting as something to admire from afar, like Mount Rushmore. As a fellow transplant, I was struck by Michael Steinberg's essay From Manhattan to Leelanau about coming to terms with the fact that the temporary job he took 40 years ago at Michigan State University turned out to be anything but. Steinberg's essay also includes an unlikely comparison between New York and Michigan I found quite charming. He writes, "Situated right at the tip of Michigan's little finger, North Point often reminds me of 129th Street in Rockaway Beach, and even of certain small neighborhoods in the Greenwich Village of my college days." The collection ends with moving essays by Ara D. Matthews and Ari L. Mokdad about the burden of racism. Mokdad, an Arab American doctoral student at Wayne State University, writes straightforward, unadorned, powerful prose about the impact of racism on her life, writing, "I'm exhausted. I don't want to explain my culture to someone who believes that all Arabs are terrorists, or that I know how to stop ISIS, or that I am the one who caused 9/11, or that I knew where Osama was hiding. Seriously, these were all questions." In the introduction, Oman says she hopes these essays reflect the spiritual weather here in Michigan, the interconnection between all of our residents. I believe she has succeeded in that endeavor, and I agree with the assessment of fiction writer Jack Driscoll, who said of Elemental, "The magic of this collection is the way in which each of these distinct and individual voices coalesce, montage-like, into a single defining declaration of what it means to fully embrace and celebrate a place and its inhabitants in such a reckless and troubled time." The spirit of this book resonated days later like pure song.
Kelly Forden reviewing the book Elemental, a collection of Michigan creative nonfiction. Forden is a poet and fiction writer. Her collection of linked stories, Garden for the Blind, was a 2015 Michigan Notable Book. And her latest book of poetry, Goodbye Toothless House, is out now. Tom Izzo called it one of the great team efforts and says it's his biggest win at Chrysler Arena. That is Coach Izzo's take as his Michigan State Spartans beat Michigan 77-70 at Chrysler, putting the MSU right at the top of the Big Ten. Michigan Radio sports commentator John U. Bacon is here. Now, John, what did you see in that Spartan win?
A very impressive effort. The first half, by the way, as I tweeted last night, as you saw, was one of the best first halves of a basketball game I have ever seen.
Now, why?
Man, it was both sides firing like crazy, a shootout. Great offenses on both sides. Pretty good defense. It wasn't like they were playing horrible defense. It was great intensity, focus. And that's unusual because the first half of a basketball game I can usually skip, frankly, because it all boils down to the last 5 minutes anyway and blah, blah, blah. But, man, this was a This was a great shootout, just fantastic basketball, great energy in the building. And I'm telling you right now, the Michigan-Michigan State rivalry is the best in the country. It does not get credit for this. It's UNC and Duke and blah, 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 blah. Well, UNC had to claim it's not a university in order to keep its banner. So, no, you're out, in my opinion. Kentucky and Louisville, the only question is who's cheating more this week, basically. So, these guys, Beeline ranked number one in integrity, is on number six amongst their peers in the CBS poll. And they're here in the state. I'm telling you right now, this is the state of Michigan basketball at its absolute best.
And you were saying to me, Michigan State Spartans had no business winning that game.
They didn't. Because they've got two stars out. Joshua Langford, his foot in January. He's out for the season, one of their stars. Nick Ward went out just last week. And you might have seen his hand in a big old cast right there. Those are two of your best players, period. You're playing at Chrysler. Michigan has not lost at Chrysler all season. They are the seventh-ranked team in the nation. The Spartans, number 10, they're no slouches. But in that environment, they probably should have lost by 10.
And who gets credit?
Izzo and Cassius Winston. The whole team does. He's right. Mm-hmm. The whole team played.
In fact, Izzo said in the locker, he said afterwards that Cassius Winston made other players better.
He did. And he's had a bad run against Michigan. Michigan's had a very good run against Izzo the last 6-7 years. Mm-hmm. Beeline has. Give him credit, man. They played fantastic basketball. Michigan did not play its best. The Spartans had to play their very best, and they did. And think about that comment from Izzo. He's played at Chrysler at least 20 times as a head coach. That's your best?
Biggest win for him.
Gets my attention. Hats off.
So how does Sunday's game set up both teams? I know they're meeting March 9th in East Lansing, and then the Big Ten title.
Muhammad Ali Frazier, baby. This is great stuff. And if you don't care, if you care just a little bit about basketball, check this game out. It'll be great.
What about March Madness? Is it too early to kind of look ahead and see where this might position?
It's never too early.
Get ready. He's salivating, rubs his hand.
What you see is this, that Michigan State can compete without two of its best players. Nick Ward should be back pretty soon. We're not quite sure when. So they won't have them both gone the whole time. Michigan is clearly not... They're not at 100%. They need another shooter and maybe another defender, frankly. The defense broke down the stretch. So today's practice will be very focused.
I want to pivot over to the shoe incident.
Yes.
College basketball's number one prospect, Duke Zion Williamson, and that Nike sneaker blowing open 36 seconds into a game. He limps off the court. Nike stock fell. And there was this burst of op-ed pieces and tweets about NCAA and players not being paid. What's your take?
Well, the horrible situation is lucky it's a mild sprain. He'll be back all as well. But what if he had blown out his knee with that shoe? And Nike, of course, is the one giving dozens of millions of dollars to Coach K at Duke and all the rest. So it would have looked very, very ugly. Now, here's the beautiful irony.
Okay.
That now Zion Williamson has all the shoe companies by the laces, if you will, because if Nike doesn't sign him, they get all the Puma or Adidas or somebody else, Reebok, and say, look, Nike shoe blew out. Run that thing nonstop. All right, it'll cost Nike so much money that now Nike's got to double their bid to keep Zion Williamson in the Nike family. That was the best thing that could have happened to his financial career.
Once he gets to the NBA and he can take advantage of that.
Yeah, let's hope he does, because screw those guys.
Well, you know, what about this? And you have talked about this, these players not being paid and the NCAA's age limit and the NBA
ridiculous
draft. So should a Zion Williamson have to risk his pro career playing for free at Duke until he can go to the NBA?
No. The Bacon theory goes, the question always boils down to pay the players, don't pay the players. Mm-hmm. I say it's the wrong question. Because even if you pay the players, it'll be chump change. So now you're a poorly paid professional. Mm-hmm. And it creates far more complications than people realize. Title IX never loses. If you pay Zion Williamson $5,000 a semester, guess what? The backup coxswain in the women's rowing team gets $5,000 and that adds up. So it's not going to be a simple formula. My theory is you need a viable minor league. In basketball and football, the same thing you've had in hockey and baseball for a century. So if you don't want to be a student and you want to get paid, go right ahead.
Does that lower the caliber of college sports if the best are heading off to that minor league?
Obviously, you're losing some great players that way. You'll keep plenty of players. Look, why do we watch March Madness? They're not better than the NBA. It's not skill we're watching for. It's passion. It's attachment. The NCAA does not understand why we like the thing that they sell. They don't get it.
Michigan Radio sports commentator, John U. Bacon. As always, John, thank you.
Thank you.
There are some Michigan-connected people celebrating today in a post-Oscar glow after films they worked on won Academy Awards last night. First off, period, end of sentence. It won the Oscar for Best Documentary Short Film. Its photographer and editor, Sam Davis, grew up in Potterville in mid-Michigan, and he was on this program Thursday. Its director, Rekha Zektabshi, gave a memorable acceptance speech.
I'm not crying because I'm on my period or anything. I can't believe a film just won an Oscar.
The film tells the story of women and girls in rural India fighting for menstrual equality. Also, the best live-action short film was Skin, about an American neo-Nazi. It earned Oscars for the husband and wife team of Guy Nativ and Jamie Ray Newman. She's from Farmington Hills in Oakland County and graduated from Cranbrook.
We dedicate this to our, oh my God, our five-month-old baby who's sitting at home with my parents watching this. We hope that you grow up in a world where these things don't happen because people learn to love and accept each other.
And Flint native Eric Porn's part of the team that won an Oscar for Best Makeup for Vice, helping transform Christian Bale into Dick Cheney and Sam Rockwell into George W. Bush. Congratulations to all. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty.
They seem to be business friendly.
Business friendly environment.
The Supreme Court's latest term was the most business friendly in recent memory.
We have a much more business friendly administration.
Business friendly is, I don't know, I never thought about that.
Politicians often use buzzwords from phrases like media elite, fake news, death tax, welfare state. Some of these seem straightforward enough, and others might take some explanation. After the recent election cycle, a Michigan radio listener reached out to us with a question.
My name is Ellen Rustin, and I was raised in the Ann Arbor-Chelsea region, and I'm a former business owner. I heard the interview with Senator Shirky, and he was talking about making Michigan more business friendly, and it started me questioning, what does that mean exactly?
So we're looking for answers to that question. What does business friendly actually mean? We reached out to business leaders and business owners throughout the state for some definitions, and we've put together a series of conversations. Today, we dig into what the phrase business friendly means for women and minority business owners in Michigan. Here now is Terry Barkley. She's president of Inforum, a nonprofit with offices in Detroit and Grand Rapids focused on the advancement of women in business. Also with us is Jamil Robinson. He's the founder of Grand Rapids Area Black Businesses, and it's a pleasure to welcome both of you to Stateside.
Thanks for having
me. Great to be here.
We wanted to find out what business owners think when they hear politicians use that term business friendly. What do they think politicians mean? So we checked around a little bit. Here's what we heard.
My name is Ryan Akowski. I'm the owner of State of Comics in downtown Plymouth. The purpose of a politician using any trendy phrase is to get business owners to back them. And that's literally it, in my opinion. I don't think it has any meaning at all to them. I just think that they are trying to get votes.
Jamil, what do you think when you hear Ryan say that? And again, he's reacting to when he hears politicians talk about the fact that they want Michigan to be business friendly.
I do believe most of it is rhetoric that they use on the campaign trail. But it's also come to who are they making the state or the environment business friendly toward. And so they could have a certain demographic of folks that they are interested in making it business friendly for, but it doesn't, it may not include every aspect of the business community in this multifaceted relation.
And Terry, what's your take on Ryan's comment?
Well, I think Jamil makes a great point. You know, the business community is very diverse, and so business friendly means very different things if you're a Fortune 500 company versus a shop in Plymouth or a startup tech company. And it all relates, I think, to that access to opportunity, removing any regulatory barriers that are limiting your growth, and providing that access to capital that helps you grow. Politicians, I think, you know, I think they're authentically interested, many of them anyway, in creating a more business-friendly environment. And the newer elected officials, I've seen them do a lot of listening to understand what that means and how they can help.
Let's listen to another business owner's point of view.
My name is April Anderson. I am the co-owner and pastry chef here at Good Cakes and Bakes, which is in the city of Detroit on the Avenue of Fashion. So for me, a person who wants to make their agenda business friendly would definitely offer more incentives for small business owners when it comes to hiring, offer more tax credits, more initiatives to offer resources within the city to small business owners. That's what I would like to see if you say your agenda is business friendly, opposed to the current situation where it's more corporate friendly, where the tax breaks and tax abatements and credits are being given to billionaire business owners and business owner, you know, corporations to get you to come into the city or come into the state. So we're offering you all of these great tax credits and these tax abatements. And then the load of that is being pushed off onto small business owners.
So April clearly believes Michigan is much more corporate or billionaire friendly than small business friendly. Kind of building on what you said, what do you want to add to that, Jamil?
Yeah, it's definitely more geared towards the corporate. Even when you look at some of the abatements and incentives that are offered, it's usually a high cost to even be able to access those incentives. So if you're a business owner and you buy an older property, and it may qualify for a brownfield abatement, but the application cost and things like that can be prohibitive for smaller businesses. And so they usually opt not to take advantage of tax abatements. And so if you're making it business friendly, you want to be able to lower the cost of entry to these different abatements, whether it's, you know, the neighborhood enterprise zones and so on and so forth that require a higher dollar match, especially if we're looking at businesses that are in underserved and disadvantaged communities. The barriers could be the application fees that the city charges just to submit different forms and so on and so forth, whether you're looking for it, whether it's code. So it's not a tiered system. And so the abatements here and the tax incentives here is, you know, if a multi-million dollar or billion dollar company needs to fill out a form and have a process through the city, they're going to pay the same amount as a mom and pop or a lifestyle business or a small business owner. And so the cost of entry can be steep for businesses when it comes to that.
So in other words, Dan Gilbert has no problem with anything that it costs for brownfield credits, but businesses like April's would.
Yes.
We're speaking with Terry Barkley, the president of Inforum, a nonprofit focused on the advancement of women in business in Michigan, and Jamil Robinson, creator and founder of Grand Rapids Area Black Businesses, as we kind of dig into what does it mean when politicians say they want Michigan to be business friendly? What does business friendly actually mean? And actually, I put that question recently to Michigan House Speaker Lee Chatfield when he was on Stateside. Let's listen to what he said.
I think business friendly means that we're going to trust the business environment to work for itself rather than government always having the answer. And I think when we look around the state and policies that we've adopted over the past several years, our economy has boomed. And the reason is Lansing doesn't always have the answers. And we need on the state of Michigan a big sign that says open for business. Because the fact is when businesses are doing well in our state and our economy is doing well, that means the people are doing well. And I think that's what it means to be business friendly.
Jamil, is there a sense from that answer from Speaker Chatfield that, it's on businesses rather than the government always having the answer? Did you pick that up?
I did. I don't necessarily agree with that. I think government definitely plays a role. And government should be a facilitator of that. Just leaving it to the hands of businesses can be a thing, especially, you know, in the system in which we have in this country, which is capitalism. It can lead to greed. And so if we're just open for business, but, you know, we're not making sure that the people and the employees and labor is taken care of, I think we are seeing the results that we're seeing right now. So even though there has been growth, it's been growth of low income jobs, and we haven't seen that. And so government can definitely come in one of the ways in which was changed recently was the minimum wage law. And so when ballot initiatives and things like that to try and make it, you know, the paid sick leave and things like that, that's where government can step in and make sure that businesses are being actually good for Michigan and not good just for themselves. And so and also government can help regulate to make sure that businesses are making sure that there's dignity when it comes to the type of employment that they're offering. And so not just saying, oh, well, you have any job, but you have to work five jobs and also do Uber and Lyft and Shipt in order to make it in the state.
To the point of sick time and minimum wage, that was opposed, though. Those ideas were opposed by many small businesses, were they not, saying they would be hurt if those were enacted?
Yeah, but, you know, they did say that it will be hurt if it's enacted in that way. And so government needs to be a facilitator in helping to alleviate some of those burdens that will be put on small businesses. And so through, like April said, a comment before, is different kind of incentives and abatements for smaller employees who can't necessarily face the brunt of the implementation of those. And so we see different kind of abatements and incentives for different companies. Like if you take in a returning citizen, there's different tax abatements and things like that. And so if government is creative in the way in which it uses its current tax base, but then also see how it can have businesses be more equitable in that sense, I think you wouldn't necessarily see small businesses, I don't think, would be as opposed if they knew that the government would assist in some way in meeting those needs and breaking some of those changes that, as far as minimum wage and paid sick time.
Terry Barkley, what's your take on that question of sick time and minimum wage?
Well, the women business owners that I know have varying opinions about that. I have heard some small business owners be very supportive of that. Because, interestingly, when you get to the issue of access to talent and competing for top talent, even though this was going to create more of a burden for them to meet, they recognized that in order to compete with top talent, they needed to be able to compete with some of the large corporations where people can choose to go to work. In this environment where we have close to zero unemployment by some measures, anything that we can do to level out the playing field for access to talent is seen as helpful for some. I really think, though, it's important to focus on the bigger issues around what it means to be business friendly, because different industries, different sizes of companies are going to have different takes on regulation and tax policy and incentives. But the core issues that I just hear coming up over and over again are about access to capital, access to talent, and access to opportunity and networks. And I do think that there's things from a policy perspective that can be done there. Here's a startling statistic for you to just dramatize a little bit of how big an issue it is. In 2018, all female founders combined received $10 billion less in funding than the e-cigarette company Juul took in by itself during that year. Mm-hmm. There's a group, PitchBook, that tracks data. It's a data company that tracks investments, and they just show again that the progress is stalled, that female-led startups got just 2.2% of all venture capital funding in 2018. 2.2%. Hmm. And that is the exact same number as they had in 2017. So, you know, when you think of what really provides the fuel for growing a company, access to capital has got to be up there. And so what can we do? We need to face up to the data about women and minority-led firms and realize that we still really don't have a level playing field out there. I don't know what you think, Jamil.
No, I definitely agree. Access to capital is by far the largest issue, I believe, in the African-American business community here in Michigan, but even nationally. Being able to access capital when you need, so responsive capital, but also some of the CDFIs and other non-traditional lenders, it takes anywhere from 3 to 6 months to be able to access those funds. And, you know, that's usually, you know, the time in which a business could potentially go out of business waiting for that infusion of capital. And so we have to look at creative ways in which we can get capital into businesses' hands a lot quicker, but then also access to capacity building opportunities. And so, and that comes through like procurement in a lot of different ways, you know, from the public sector, looking at some of their largest bids. So here in Grand Rapids, if there's, you know, like 100 parks and they all need plow service, and the city is going to put that up for bid instead of putting out all 100 parks to be bid by one huge company. How can we break those bids down to some of the smaller businesses? Those businesses are just starting, so then they have opportunities to, one, build their capacity to serve larger and larger bids and contracts by getting that initial contract win, so they can build the capacity, it can expand their fleet and those type of things like that. But if it's always going to the largest of the largest businesses, then there are no opportunity for small businesses and African-American businesses to be able to get on to some of those vendor opportunities. I think that's where we're losing out.
So the capital, the networking, the being thought of, the saying, for example, to cities, communities, to leaders, just because we've always done it a certain way doesn't mean we should keep doing that. So new ways, as you say, of looking at bidding processes. And
correct.
Are there any initiatives in Michigan happening now that you are encouraged about, ways to elevate businesses run by, owned by people of color, owned by women? Are there any initiatives where you're like, you know what, this is the way of the future?
Short answer is, oh my, yes. I think there's a lot going on, but Jamil, why don't you start?
There's a ton of efforts taking place in a lot of different communities across the state. Some are having varying degrees of success, because it really still comes down to the implementation of those. So we can have very great ideas, and we can even write it very well on paper and have an excellent implementation plan, but if it's not executed in the way in which it was. And so, you know, if you look at some of the things that are taking place here in the city of Grand Rapids, you know, like one of which is the program that we partner with, my organization partnered with the city of Grand Rapids, to where we're accelerating African-American businesses. And so we recently just had one of our participants secure $250,000 in funding that they otherwise wouldn't have been able to access without our partnership and our program assisting them in that way. And I know it's a ton of programs across the state, some in Detroit. You know, we've done different collaborations with different organizations over in Detroit.
And Terry, you were like, oh, yes, there are.
There really are. And I have to give a shout out to the New Economy Initiative in Southeast Michigan that over the past years has provided philanthropic support to build out a whole system, multiple organizations who provide varying kinds of support with a special focus on women and minority-led ventures. There's been a growth in business plan competitions like NEI Ideas and many others that help provide funding to worthy startups. And there are organizations that are really focused, they're really doubling down their efforts focused on women and minority-led companies. My own organization, for example, has a program called Engage that is focused on female founders, women-led companies. And what we do is we do custom resource mapping, so we connect those female funders directly with the resources they need when they need them. So if they can sit down and talk to funders, everything from banks to venture capital and private equity funders, depending on the stage of their business. We connect them to advisors that can help them navigate that regulatory environment that they're facing. But most of all of these programs, and I'm sure Jamil does this as well, connect female and minority founders with each other so that there is a vibrant support network that's there not just for the concrete hands-on tasks, but, you know, to provide those words of encouragement and the perspective and inspiration that help you keep going and help you learn, hear the stories of other founders and how have they navigated these tricky waters. And I sometimes think that's more important than anything, to be able to have that encouragement that helps you keep going.
Access to capital, access to top talent, access to networking, some of the ideas for making Michigan more business friendly to businesses owned by people of color, owned by women. It's been a great conversation. We want to thank Jamil Robinson, creator and founder of the Grand Rapids Area Black Businesses, and Terry Barkley, president of Inforum, that is a nonprofit that's focused on the advancement of women in business. Thank you to both of you.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Cindy.
Today's Stateside was directed by Mercedes Mejia and engineered by Bob Scahn. Our executive producer is Joe Lindstraw. Contributors are Mike Blank, April Van Buren, Joey Horan, Bella Isaacs, Razi Jaffrey, and Sarah Leeson. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.